Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham. Once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved in punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, huge guest, ginormous guest, the legend, Billy Bragg, from the band Riff Raff, from his own solo work, from his collaboration with Wilco, from just a legend. A legend, a genuine legend. More on that in a second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and the guy who runs the Facebook page and the guy who runs the Instagram page, Tristan Abraham, and guest booker extraordinaire. For people that are hitting me up right now saying, my gosh, the booking has been incredible lately, don't thank me. Thank Tristan. He's the one who hit me up and said, what about Billy Bragg? And I'm like, I love Riff Raff. And here we are. So thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do. If you would like to get in touch with me more directly, you can find me at Left4Damien on both Instagram and Twitter. If you want to support the podcast, the best way to support the podcast is just telling everyone you know. Letting everyone know that you know that we have a podcast where we have a pretty good range of guests all talking about punk rock. And that's how we spread the word. You can also support the podcast by subscribing to it and rating it on your platform of choice, or by heading over to patreon.com/turnedoutapunk and getting involved over there. We do footnotes, and thank you. Thank you. Thank you to everyone over there who has been involved and helped us. We've had some technical problems lately, and without that Patreon, I don't know if this podcast would still be going on, you know, because the money's tight around the podcast sometimes. So, you know, and it would be even tighter without the kind, loving support of the fine folks at Vans, who came on board a couple years ago and said, Damien, do what you do. Just don't do it out of your pocket. And they've helped me cover a lot of these costs for this thing. It's expensive to run a free podcast, you know, like it takes a little bit of money. So thank you so much to the fine folks at Vans for helping me out and being my buddies. They're, you know, I hung out with a bunch of people over a Zoom chat this week, and we talked music, and I miss them so much, because normally I'd be seeing them all summer long at those House of Vans events, and I have not. So thank you to everyone at Vans, Brianna and Brooke, and yeah, thank you to them. All right, on to today's show. Today on the show, we have a legend, as I said off the top. Billy Bragg is here. Now, Billy Bragg is someone that I'm pretty sure most of us are familiar with. If you're not familiar with Billy Bragg, he is, you know, a troubadour beyond reproach. He is a British songwriting legend, international songwriting legend, and someone I've always wanted to talk to because, you know, like he's done all that. And you can hear interviews where people talk to him about that pretty extensively and about his involvement with politics and, you know, and not to undermine any of that, because that all is very important. But when Billy Bragg was going to come on this show, you know, we're going to be talking to him about his first band, Riff Raff, you know? And so the chance to sit down and talk to Billy Bragg about, God, one of the great Chiswick punk bands. You know, I think that I Want to Be a Cosmonaut is a classic that stands up there with all the great punk songs of the era. You know, like it is truly like a top tier punk record. And I had so many questions, and by God, Billy Bragg answered them. I don't think you need me to ramble on anymore. You want to hear Billy Bragg talk, and I assure you, this is one of my favorite episodes I've ever done. Oh my gosh, this was a lot of fun. I don't even think I have any notes to get to this week. No, that's it. Check out Billy Bragg's actually triple LP, Best of the BBC Sessions, which came out on Cooking Vinyl last year. And it's a monster. It's a monster. Got a lot of classic cuts. Billy Bragg is one of those artists who, you know, obviously a incredible discography of records, but some of these sessions that he did at the BBC, chilling. Okay, that's it. I got nothing else to waste your time with this week. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Billy Bragg on Turned Out a Punk. Billy, thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure, mate. Good to speak to you.
Well, as I was just telling you off air, you played an OCAP rally here in Toronto years ago, and that was a real pivotal show for me. And I think, really impacted how I felt like musicians have an obligation to act. So I, you know, just to thank you personally for that, off the bat.
My pleasure. You know, I've always tried to sort of do a little bit more than just sing about it, to actually try and, you know, engage with what's going on rather than just reflecting it. And if you try, you'd be surprised at what impact it can have.
Well, I am very excited to talk to you, not just for that kind of, you know, sort of gems that you kind of just give out like that, but also because I am a huge, huge fan of Riff Raff. So let's get started the way they all start off here on the show. Billy, yeah. How did you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
Yes, I do. I do. Obviously, you know, when I was 19 years old, 18, 19 years old, there was three really good music papers in the UK. There was New Musical Express, Enemy, Melody Maker, and Sounds. And I think Sounds had really got onto punk, but I hadn't heard anything. And then a friend of mine came around with a reel-to-reel tape machine, and he had the first Damned album on this reel-to-reel tape machine.
Like a reel-to-reel version of the first Damned record?
I think he taped it off someone.
Okay, totally.
In the old days before Walkmans and all that kind of stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. I think he'd been to someone's house and taped it from them. And so he was bringing it round to us to, you know, to bring the good news that punk had arrived. And he played it. And me and Wiggy, my kind of like best pal and the guy who taught me to play guitar, I was in a band with, we were absolutely convinced he was playing it at the wrong speed. We're like, no way. No way is this the new music. It's the wrong speed, man. You've recorded it wrong. And my friend's going like, no, this is it. This is actually it. So I'll be honest with you, we were a little skeptical. Mm-hmm. About punk to start with. I think I had a sense that it was some of the bands seemed to me to have a bit of an art school sensibility, you know, painting their trousers and stuff like that. And I was rather suspicious of all that it would just be like really would be just like Roxy Music or something. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of a bit standoffish, but the one punk band that really did impress us was the Jam. And I think what was different about the Jam was they seemed to have a more working class ethic. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't look like they'd been to art school, whereas the Clash and the Pistols looked a bit art schooly. So the Jam were also referencing the kind of music that me and my friends had been listening to that summer. So early Stones, early Who, early Small Faces. So we went to see the Jam and we were quite enamored of the Jam for a while. In small pubs in London, we would go and see them. And their first single, In the City, I bought that and just thought that was brilliant.
Were you aware of like bands like, you know, Dr. Feelgood and sort of like that kind of pub rock scene that was going on at the same time, or even like a band like Juke? Because you guys would eventually do a split with Juke. Like
I wasn't aware of you, but I was definitely aware of Dr. Feelgood. Although at the time, I didn't realize what a precursor they were. In many ways, the Feelgoods are like the British Ramones.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, they've gone back to basics and they're connecting with some essential core of guitar music at a time when so much guitar music was going. I don't know where it was going. You only have to listen to, I can't think what his name was now, but there was a guy who had a hit single the summer of 76 called Music Was My First Love. It might have just been called Music. Mm-hmm. And he was a guitar player. And it was just so, it was orchestral. It was all over the place. It was like, oh, you're kidding me. And all of a sudden the Feel Good's coming. It's just not only did they punch a hole in that, almost physically, but they look like they really don't care what you think about them. Mm-hmm. In fact, you better not look at Lee Brillo because he'll probably beat you up if he catches you looking at him. And then with Wilco Johnson, you've got this guitar anti-hero. He's not trying to give you the impression that he's some kind of god. He's giving you this kind of twitchy thing that's kind of almost the well, in my school, it's the kind of behavior that would have gotten you beaten up by everyone. And for this to be up on stage and be lauded, it really was a real shock to our system. And he did this incredibly revolutionary thing that I'd never seen anybody do before. And that was, he did up the top button of his shirt. And that was so the opposite of what the Bee Gees were doing with Saturday Night Fever, where their shirts were open to their airy belly buttons.
Yeah, yeah.
That it was just, I don't know, it just, the thing about the Feel Goods was they were kind of unprepossessing blokes. And there's a lot of us out there, you know. I'm an unprepossessing bloke. Weller was an unprepossessing bloke. Costello, Ian Dury, you know, I mean, we're all unprepossessing blokes. And the Feel Goods kind of made that cool and tough and edgy. So although we were into the Feel Goods, because they also fit into that aesthetic that I'm talking about, that early guitar aesthetic, the key thing about them was they were older than us. Or rather, the key thing about the Jam was they were the same age. It's really that way around. The key thing about the Jam was they were the same age as us. And that was that experience of seeing someone on stage the same age as you that's in a band doing something that people like, that was, that idea really took off for me and my friends when we went to see The Clash. Now, the reason we went to see The Clash was because the Jam was supporting them. And we believed that the Jam would show these art school fellas what, you know, what real music was about.
Yeah.
It was at the Rainbow, which was a big gig in North London where all the bands played. I think we'd been there to see the Small Faces revival earlier that year, which wasn't great, I'll be honest with you. But it wasn't just the Jam and The Clash. It was the White Riot Tour. So it was the Jam, The Clash, the Buzzcocks, the Subway Sect. And people say the Slits played as well, but I don't remember that. But it might have been that we got there late and they did play, but I don't remember seeing. I think I'd have remembered seeing the Slits. You'd never forget that, surely. But that day, that night at the Rainbow, a couple of things happened. The Jam, it was just too big for the Jam. They hadn't worked out how to play a stage that was, you know, five times wider than the one at the Nashville Rooms, whereas The Clash seemed to have it. And The Clash were throwing all the shapes and that we really liked about the Stones and the Who, which is what me and my friends had been listening to before. But the key thing about it was they were our age and they were up there headlining where we'd seen our heroes. This is the place where we went to see our heroes. So going to see The Clash, we came away realization that you don't actually need someone to come along and tell you to be in a band. You just be in a band. That's how you do it. You just do it, you know, and that's what we did.
You mentioned that Small Faces revival show. Did Coxbar open that show? Do you remember?
Oh, dear.
Because they did a tour.
Now you're really asking me. I don't remember that.
Okay.
But, it's possible because they did do some shows around that time, didn't they? But the Coxbarrow used to play at the our local gig, which was the Bridge House at Canning Town. That was kind of because we lived in East London. We were on a kind of different circuit to the one that the Clash and the Jam regularly played. You know, they were in a very much of a West London circuit, and the East London circuit was a bit more heavy metal.
Okay.
You know, it was kind of a place where Iron Maiden came out of and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
The trousers were just as tight, but the hair was longer.
you mentioned Ian Dury earlier. Were you a fan of Kilburn and the High Roads as well?
No, I wasn't aware of Kilburn and the High Roads, I'll be honest with you.
Okay.
That might have passed me by.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of thing we were listening to, I was listening to a lot of singer-songwriters in the sort of pre-punk period. But something had happened. Me and my pals were playing in my parents' back room when my parents used to go out to take my brother to swimming galas on Saturday night. We would rock up in our back room and set up me and Wiggy playing guitars and Bob from around the corner playing drums. And we were basically doing Stones, Who, bit of Feel Goods. There's a picture somewhere of me and Wiggy impersonating the Feel Goods. It's not a very good impersonation, but we were kind of on that tip.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, and that kind of played what happened in that summer. Robert round the corner, his parents went away for 2 weeks. We went and lived at his house for 2 weeks. And we all went out and bought the first two albums by the Stones, the Who, and the Small Faces, and just kind of really, really got into that. And the Shangri-Las as well, for some reason. They were big in that period. And that's where we were when punk happened.
So how long after that was it that Riff Raff starts?
Oh, we'd already were playing. We were already playing. That Riff Raff was more or less me and Wiggy on guitar, Bob on drums, and whoever came around to play the bass. Yeah, we were just knocking around in back rooms, but we weren't really tuned into punk rock. There's a rehearsal studio up on the A13 in Raynham, where we used to go and book the whole of Saturday night and just stay up all night playing. And when I look back at that, songs are starting to creep in. We thought the Eddie and the Hot Rods Live at the Marquee EP was really good. Mm-hmm. We used to play Get Out of Denver very fast. We kind of overcame our fear of playing fast. But it wasn't until the summer of 77 where we decided that we wanted to go on holiday together, somewhere where we could stay up all night and play all week and do some recording. And we found this out-of-the-way recording studio in Northamptonshire, which is about 100 miles from London, up the middle of the country. And we went up there, and before we got there, I had already written, I Want to Be a Cosmonaut.
Oh, wow.
So I'd already kind of made that leap. I'd heard the Ramones at some point, mm-hmm. and really liked the Ramones. And I'd moved on to trying to stop writing songs like the Rolling Stones and Jackson Browne and start writing songs like the Ramones and the Clash and the Jam. And that was very fruitful week. I mean, we had a great time. And the most important thing about it was the people who ran it, they were old hippies, you know, but they were really cool people and they had music industry connections. And they took us seriously as musicians, as a band, which our parents and our friends never did. So it was a real watershed experience for us all. In many ways, we never came home, me, Wiggy, and Robert.
Well, you kind of talked about it earlier with the Jam. Like, it's amazing how punk rock, you know, and rap music, obviously, now, but like, some of the few places where it really privileges youthful expression.
Oh, yeah. I mean, not just youthful expression, but... you know, a kind of a self-empowering attitude, very much. I mean, that, you know, punk to me was all about self-empowerment. And so that's why I still think of myself in those terms, because, you know, if I want to do something, if I want to write a book, I don't ask someone if I can write a book, I write it.
Yeah.
You know, I don't need the justification to do something, but, you know, I don't need the qualifications. I just kind of go and do it. Although I will admit to wearing the torn trousers and the you know, short hair and all that kind of stuff. It really was much more of an attitude to me. And I got it a lot from, you know, from In the City by the Jam, you know, you better listen now. You've said your bit, you know, you've said your bit, mate. The older generation have said what they had to say. You better listen now, cause I'm going to talk now. And that's a really, really empowering line. I mean, the more time passes, the more I realize how much more influence I really, if I was being honest, the Jam were a much bigger influence on me than the Clash.
I think also, just to go back to I Want to Be a Cosmonaut, like, that is such a killer song. Like, it just, it rages so hard.
It does. I mean, we were full of it. That and Romford Girls.
Yeah.
We wrote that while we were up there. Stayed up all night recording those two, and woke up in the morning and it was dawn, and we went outside and we were like, it was almost like we were reborn as new people. Really, it really felt like that. It felt like we weren't the same people that went in the studio before, some blokes who were going to record a song. We were now a real band, and it really felt we'd stepped over a threshold. And it's because of the people who ran the studio, Ruin and Jackie O'Loughlin, believed in us, and they gave us that confidence to do that and be ourselves, you know. And the other great thing was they had really good contacts with Chiswick Records. Ruin was a musician who'd been in a number of bands. Most recently, when we met him, he'd been playing with Ronnie Lane out of Faces. It was another band that we were huge fans of. And he had good contacts with Chiswick Records, and he got us a little EP deal, which we, you know, the Cosmonaut EP came out of that.
Was there like, when you said earlier that they were hippies, were they kind of part of that whole Pink Fairies kind of deviance kind of scene?
No, they were, Ruin was come out of Ireland. He was a pub band called Bees Make Honey.
Okay.
Who played they were one of the key bands that kicked off the pub rock phase by playing in Irish pubs around London, playing good time music in Irish pubs around London. And he played with a few other people. He played saxophone, and he played everything, really, but he's a really good saxophonist, and he was a really good pianist. And in that sense, he'd been a sideman for Ronnie Lane on the Slim Chance album. And that was an album that Wiggy and I, we really loved that record. We couldn't believe it when we got there and found out it was him. And it kind of was one of those moments of, you know, that connection that we with the musicians that we deeply admired. And his wife, Jackie, as well, really was really, really encouraging.
So was it only the four songs that you recorded that day, or did you guys record more?
No, I recorded loads of stuff. We probably recorded about a dozen songs.
And is that all stuff that's unreleased, that's not on the other singles that came out?
One or two of them might be. I mean, basically, the place they ran was a place called Bear Shanks, mm-hmm. the name of the farmhouse studio. And we did two big sessions there, one in 1977 and another one in 1979. The 1979 one is a lot more sort of sharper and focused. The 1977 one is kind of like a explosion in a song factory. You know, quick, here's a tune, write it down, let's do it. I mean, we didn't need any drugs that week because we were kind of high the whole time we were there.
Yeah.
You know, we were just buzzing all the time we were there. We drank a lot of beer, we wrote a lot of songs, we stayed up all night, and then we kind of started going up there on spare weekends when we could. And eventually, you know, they got us a few gigs in London. They got some. We kind of became the default support band for Chiswick Records artists, beginning with R, who were playing at the Marquee. So the Radiators from Space, the Radio Stars. We kind of opened for all of them. It was cool. I mean, to play at the Marquee, I mean, it was just, you know, again, it was another dream come true for me. There's a photograph of me playing and shouting and pointing in front of the Marquee sign. And if I never done anything else ever again, just having that, I would have felt that I was a part of something really important. I was a part of punk rock.
Well, yeah, I was such a huge fan of that single. And, like, you know, only did I find out kind of years later that it was you. Like, I put it together. I'm like, oh, shit, that's Billy Bragg, like the Billy Bragg.
Yeah.
But it's like such a career you had before your career.
Yeah, it was really. And that was, you know, something that I'm inordinately proud of, you know, to have had a record out on Chiswick Records as well, one of the great indie punk labels.
Oh, of all time, yeah.
Yeah, it's something that I'm very proud of. And what came later is the continuation. It's not a stop and start.
Mm-hmm.
It's all part and parcel. And we actually got together. It's the only gig I'm going to do this year by the look of things. We got together for Wiggy's 60th birthday and did a show at Dingwalls.
Oh, wow, that's awesome.
It was awesome because we saw a lot of old friends there. Jackie O'Loughlin was there with her two sons. I'm sadly ruined, passed away in the 80s. We were talking about, you know, maybe releasing the songs that we recorded at Bear Shanks at some point.
Oh, that'd be so awesome. Yeah, because it is like standalone, you know, like that single's a classic. And you mentioned Chiswick being one of the great labels. It's like 101ers, like obviously pre-Clash stuff. And then you have like yourself, obviously, Johnny Moped, Motorhead. Yeah.
That Johnny Moped record was just absolutely amazing.
Oh, I was going to say, I love the second one. Let's Have Another Baby.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the album, the psychedelic album I was thinking of. And also this sleeve designed by Barney Bubbles as well, which is an important part of the Billy Bragg thing. But yeah, if you go online, there's a recording of Kirsty MacColl and myself singing Darling, Let's Have Another Baby.
Oh, really? What, did that ever get released?
Yeah, it did. I think it was on, one of her compilations, and it's just on my most recent BBC, Billy Bragg at the BBC compilation, because we did it for a radio show. It's live in the studio. There's two of us sitting around a microphone singing it, yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. That's going to be the first thing I check out after we get off this podcast.
Yeah, because that was me and Kirsty's connection. I was a huge fan of Kirsty MacColl when she was on Polydor making her first solo albums. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that, that she was in the Drug Addicts as well.
Yeah, I guess that's like another band, Drug Addicts as well, and also Radiators from Space, you know, like the pre-Pogue stuff. It's on
edge. The Radiators from Space were a really sharp band. We played with them a couple of times. and I was a huge admirer of the way they attack songs.
Yeah, those singles, like, obviously not ever getting a chance to see them live, but those singles are just so, once again, just like rip just as hard today, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, like, where did you, what was it kind of like in that scene at that time? Like, what kind of kids were coming to see you at those shows? Was it like punk rock kids, or was it more of a pub rock crowd, or?
Well, looking back at it, it's, you know, you can tell by the haircuts. There are some hardcore punks in the audience, but they don't really like us. But there are some other people who are, you can tell by their haircuts that they've probably got a straight job. They're probably working at an office somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But when they go out at night, they get dressed up and put on quite, I mean, what this, when we played at the Marquee, one of the drum stands broke, and a guy in a white coat, like a doctor's white coat with Dr. Psycho written on the back, got out of the audience and held it. But I mean, a less psycho looking guy, you can't imagine. He had a cherubic face, curly hair, ginger. Yeah, a psycho was a cocker spaniel, be honest with you. But yeah, it was kind of, it was a generational thing, I think. You know, if we did a gig with the Radio Stars, their audience was more of a pub rock audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas the audience that was coming to see the Radiators was much more punk rock.
Did you ever play with Motorhead? Did you ever open for them?
No, I'm not sure Motorhead were on the label when we were. I think they might have been later.
Yeah, no, that's true as well. Like, it's such an amazing time that you have, you know, like, obviously, you know, like the punk stuff that's taken up sort of in the mainstream, you know, coffee table book, history of punk rock. But also you have all these, like, amazing micro scenes happening that wind up becoming much more kind of important a few years later. But, like, you know, be it Chiswick or Stiff Records, like, was there any intermingling with the Stiff stuff that was happening, or is it kind of separate worlds?
Well, you got to remember, we were living at Northamptonshire at the time, so what came up there, we would see that rather than be in London and being able to go to all the gigs. But there was some intermingling. I remember Ruin O'Loughlin, Ian Dury and the Blockheads were playing in Leicester at the De Montfort Hall, which was about 30 minutes from where we were, and he made a few phone calls and got us all tickets, and we went to see them. So they clearly, you know, there was some connection.
Yeah.
And oddly, you know, Peter Jenner, who subsequently came on to manage me as in my Billy Bragg phase, he was there that night, and I may well have snatched a plastic cup of Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll badges out of his hand that he was distributed from the stage. He wasn't quick enough. He was leaning forward and handing them out one at a time, and I was just like, and just threw them. I just threw them over my shoulder, so everyone got one further back. But yeah, I think that might have been Pete, and he doesn't remember anything about it. But obviously, when you're that close to your heroes and you're in the audience, you remember those kind of things.
Yeah, absolutely. That yeah, that'll stand out more to the fan than I guess the person it happens to.
Yeah, he just thought I was some annoying bastard who nicked his.
What about Albion Records, like that you put out that split on a few years later with Riff Raff? What was the deal with that label?
Same thing again. It's down to Ruin. Albion was a record label that had been put together by the guys who, I think they ran the Hope and Anchor. They were really promoters. They weren't really a record label, but they were just trying to get into that whole thing. The only other person I can think of that they put records out was a guy named Ian Gom, who'd been in Brinsley Schwartz. So the kind of the sort of vibe of pub rock kind of hung over labels like Chiswick and like Stiff. Whereas some of the other labels like Step Forward and, you know, Factory, they were kind of all new, you know. They hadn't come out of. There's always that kind of phase where what went before is still hanging around.
Yeah.
And the new guys come in and but it was very fruitful, you know. I think Stiff and Chiswick, you know, paved the way for making records on your own terms, both as a artist, but also importantly as a label.
I think also Albion Records too has like a really interesting discography. Like, you know, 999 records are on there, but they even put out records by the DBs.
Really?
Yeah, like they did. That's where I first became familiar with it, just from going to used record stores and buying DB records. And then I, of course, now desperately searching for the Riff Raff split on that label. But
yeah,
it's like it's an interesting discography. Robin Hitchcock record as well. Like it really.
I thought I knew about Hitchcock. Yeah. They had a go. They had a right go. I mean, that was the time when anybody could, you know. punk had opened the door, and a lot of people snipped through it. A lot of people who were, you know, not really what you necessarily call classic punk rock, but there was a space for them. All of a sudden, stuff from outside the box was possible to get in there. You know, whether it was, you know, punk rock or reggae or kind of weird jazz, there was a lot of amazing music going on at the time.
Absolutely, yeah. That's the thing that that's what I'm obsessed with, is this idea that at that moment where punk rock finally, it all kind of coalesces and come together. Because, like, as we've talked about before, you have bands like, you know, the Stooges in America or Dr. Feelgood in England, doing this stuff beforehand. Yeah. But when it finally kind of clicks and, as you say, opens that door, you have just like a deluge of just so much interesting stuff kind of coming in with it before it gets codified and capital P punk is kind of established.
Yeah, before it becomes a fashion.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. But at the time, there was a lot of, you know, space for different people to do different things and all to be part of that dispensation, if you like. You know, the music press was open to people who were writing on that tip. I mean, Tom Petty came in that way first.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
American Girl fit into that, you know. In some ways, it is close to, if you know, it will be, if you just take American Girl, it's possible to put them in a box with the Flaming Groovies, with the Ramones, you know, with those kind of, with Jonathan Richman, you know.
Yeah. No, if it had come out on Bomp Records, it would, and that was it, yeah, it would be a power pop classic.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, you know, it's kind of, that was what was exciting about that time. Lots of, you know, that Roadrunner single song had been around for years, but it took punk to make it happen.
Yeah, or even Juke, like who you wind up doing that split with years later.
Yeah, they've been a kind of slave type band, haven't they?
Yeah, and I think those singles are, you know, just like, it's amazing the stuff that it took punk to kind of turn people onto, because, you know, they're just classic kind of punk sounding songs, but before it happened.
Yeah, which is kind of, in hindsight, I guess there's always stuff out there knocking around that, but it's until you get that perspective, until you see, you know, the possibilities. You know, it's not, you're not able really to discern where it's coming from.
So going back to that Albion single that you did, was Barking Park Lake recorded in those same sessions that you were kind of going up and recording with Ruin for?
It was, but I think we went in a proper studio to record the single. But yeah, I'd written Barking Park Lake. I think I'd written a tune. And I didn't think it was going to go anywhere. And I left. I went back in the house for whatever reason, and come back, and Wiggy and Robert had written the lyrics. So it was one of those kind of weird things. It's like Romford Girls, you know. I kind of had the riff, but Robert had the lyrics. Mm-hmm. I didn't always have everything together at the time. But I'm sure we went into a proper studio and recorded that. Although I can't remember off the top of my head. I really remember the recording the Chiswick songs, but I don't really remember recording the Albion song.
Well, I'm now unfortunately going to punish you, because I have never even heard the next four singles that you did, and I'm just fascinated by them. They never seem to show up on the market. You put up four singles in the same year.
You're breaking up.
Can you hear me? Hello?
I live in a rural fastness on the... Oh, there you are. Gone again.
can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
You still there?
Yes. Yeah, we survived the drop that time.
Yeah, it's mad. I'm just putting you on speaker so we can talk. There we go. Where were we?
Well, I was about to, I think it cut off at the right time, because I was about to punish you about these Geezer records that you did.
Oh, yeah.
They never seemed to show up. Like, was it like a really small press run for those things?
Yeah, it was actually. It probably wasn't more than about, I don't know, about 500 of each, if that.
Wow, okay. That makes sense then. So what was the deal with that? Was it like from a completely different session? Is it all from the same session, I assume? Because they all came out the same year.
Yeah, they're all the same sessions. Yeah, we really should have put out a bloody album, but we were trying to do something interesting. We made little videos as well to go with all of them, which is by Jackie O'Loughlin inspired us. She was very artistic. She'd made a couple of films, and we worked with her. She made the films and we made the songs, and we tried to sort of put it out ourselves and you know, be our own, you know, stepping forward even further into, you know, self-empowerment and put out our own records. But, you know, it takes more than just putting records out. You need distribution and stuff like that. We didn't really think about that.
So you mentioned these videos. Where was your kind of hoping these things being shown at that time?
Well, you know, Jackie had connections in the film world. We were hoping to, you know, get them seen as much as a promotional tool. I mean, videos are just domestic VHS players had just started appearing. Mm-hmm. So I think we thought we might be able to sell them, like almost like video singles, I suppose.
Did you actually ever release video cassette versions of the songs too?
Not my knowledge, no.
Okay. Yeah, because I've never heard about those things showing up at all. So that would blow my mind. It'd be like the damn reel to reel that we talked about earlier showing up.
Probably just as well, Damien, I would think.
I'm relieved
that you haven't seen them.
I got to see them now. That this is like, I got to.
You of all people, you, if anyone's going to find them, you are, mate.
Well, this is now on the top of the want list now. So, but this is, so these singles, is it like similar sound? Because I've actually never gotten a chance to hear these things. Do they sound the same as the stuff you were doing earlier?
You never heard them?
No, they never show up. These are really like legitimately rare records that just don't seem to ever show up on the market.
About 20 years ago, we put them all out on a CD to sell at gigs. We reissued them all.
Even that CD's a collectible though now. So
is it?
Yeah. I might just have to buy the CD. I'm a vinyl person, but that's one CD that I think I might have to break format for.
It never was out on vinyl. It was only on CD. Because, you know, I used to, in the 90s, we were just knocking out live CDs and you know, weird sessions of stuff that we would just record and sell ourselves at gigs and not through the record company to make money straight off. Mm-hmm. And I was just saying to my partner, Juliet, who now manages me, none of that stuff is available anymore. None of it's on, it's not on Spotify or any streaming channel. We should go back and look at all that and see if we can get it out there. Because there's some nice stuff there. We went and there's Mermaid Avenue re-record of some, you know, with the band that I was playing at the time, the versions that we would play, how we would play Mermaid Avenue. Some interesting stuff.
Oh, that's awesome.
Well, listen, I'm gonna see if I can find down the back of a sofa if I can find a copy of that Riff Raff CD, and I'll send it to you if I can find it.
Oh, I would be very much obliged. And if you don't, it's now like one of those things where the CD's now over $100 itself.
No. So.
yeah, like it's a hard CD to track down now, and that's the thing is like, you know, as we've talked about, like you had this whole awesome other career. That, you know, obviously leads into the career that, you know, you're very well known for. But, like, this thing is legitimate on its own. And, you know, if those last songs had come out as an LP, who knows where that could have gone potentially.
Yeah, it is. And it's a strange kind of thing because in our own little area where we lived in eastern Northamptonshire, we were quite big. You know, we had a rep there. We had a lot of respect. We were doing, you know, we were playing. There was a pub in a village called Clopton, Clopton, which wasn't really a village. It was like a row of houses and a pub.
Okay.
And outside the pub, there was what we call a function room, which is like a long, low, single-story building with a bar at one end. And that's where people would have their wedding reception or, you know, their 21st birthday. But also, on a Friday night, you've got to remember, this is 1979. It was the biggest gay club in the east of England. And people would come from all over east of England and from Europe as well to boogie at this club. And we got in touch with them and see if we could get it for Sunday afternoon and do a residency every Sunday afternoon and invite local punk bands to come and play with us.
Oh, that's awesome.
It was awesome. It was really cool because nothing else was going on a Sunday afternoon. This is back in the days where everything was closed on Sunday.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like CBGB Sunday matinees, but
in
the rural UK.
Yeah, and nothing on the telly, nothing going on, no football, nothing.
Yeah.
And we started doing this, and it got quite a rep. One of the early ones, the Stranglers came to rehearse for their black and white album, Bearshanks. And they were there for a couple of weeks. And we got Jean-Jacques Benel, the bass player, to come down and play with us. And that kind of set us up, you know, that gave us a rep.
So who were some of the other bands that were kind of coming up, or who were some of the other bands you kind of were playing with at this kind of era? Like locally, I mean, even.
Yeah, that's a really good question. There was a band from Peterborough who eventually became the Name. It was a little bit later on. There was another band from I think they were called the Destructors. I think they came from Kimbolton.
Okay.
What was the name of this band from Peterborough? Damn, I'm really embarrassed now because my good friend Joe McColl was the drummer in it, and they had a song called Development Corporation.
The Now.
You've got it.
Yeah. That's awesome. I love that band.
Yeah. It's even more embarrassing because I wrote a song called Here Come the Now, which is really embarrassing. But I'm just having one of those blank out moments. Yeah. They were kind of like the big band in Peterborough. Then there were other bands in places like Kettering. They would come over and play. It was good fun. I mean, you know, it was sort of a way to build a bit of a scene there.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, it was miles from anywhere. So it was the only thing going on for miles and miles and miles. And it was just, I don't know, it just kind of gave us a focus every week. Otherwise, we'd have been drifting a bit, I think.
It's also, I like, you know, just the bands you just kind of rhymed off right there. Like, it's almost like after punk supposedly dies, at least in the music press definition, that's when it gets really exciting. That's when you have all these little bands popping off in their communities and putting out records and doing weird things.
Exactly, because the idea, we carried the idea off. There's a, I don't know if you've read England's Dreaming by John Savage.
Oh, yes, of course, yeah.
There's a gig where he complains miserably that this is the end of punk, where it's all over, it's finally been destroyed, and everything it ever stood for has been ruined. That gig was the White Riot tour night at the Rainbow that me and my friends went to, fired up by. Yeah. What happened? When I read that in the book, I was like, John, you've totally got the wrong end of the stick, mate. That's the moment where it goes incendiary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, you do lose control of it. You and your mates who've had control of it for the last 18 months, yeah, because we find it and we snap off the bits we need and carry them off into the night.
Mm-hmm.
And we take them out and pass on the message. So in some ways, I mean, he's right. It was the end of that phase. But for so many of us, it was the spark that lit the fire that still burns in us, you know. So that, and I understand, you know, how things carry on. I don't know if you know, a couple of years ago, I wrote a book about skiffle.
Oh, I know. I haven't read that book, but I know the genre a little bit.
Yeah. There's a great documentary made in 1960 after skiffle was supposed to be over, where they're literally interviewing this kid who's saying that skiffle is dead in Brighton. And in the background is a skiffle band playing. It's like mad. I don't know, you know, and once you get out of London, I mean, things weren't so, national in those days. It was so much more regional music.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, things were still going on in other places. You know, early on in punk, heavy metal was still big in East Northamptonshire. You had to be really careful you didn't go in the wrong pub where they're all heavy metal fans and they'd sort of get a bit edgy if someone came in with short hair.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, you could hear their flares all flapping in the wind. You know, it was if you had drainpipe trousers on, that was, you know, the precursor to a fight.
Yeah.
So it was a bit edgy up there sometimes. You know, you'd be like, oh, here we go. But we were the only punks in town. So, and because we were from London, we kind of like garnered a lot of sort of cultural clout for that. We lived in this house in town. It was like a squat, and it was one up, one down, and one in the middle. And it was right on the road, the main road from east to west. And big lorries used to come through in the middle of the night and make the whole place shake. And we called it Wobbling Heights. And my manager used to say Billy didn't go to university; he went to Riff Raff. And that was where I had all the experiences that you would normally have if you went to university. Social, sexual, you know, drug-wise, drink-wise. We had them all when we were in Riff Raff in Oundle. And it's really weird that we'd leave London and go miles and miles away but still have that experience.
Yeah, well, because it sounds like you almost brought it with you, right? Like you brought that experience with you from London.
Well, we didn't really have it. That's the thing. I mean, we didn't really have it. We read about it. didn't actually have it with us when we arrived. But the people who were there imagined that we did have it.
Yeah, of course.
So we kind of did have it, if you know what I mean.
I get it now.
It's one of those strange things where, you know, I was in East Germany once and I met some East German punks in the 1980s. And my manager, Pete, had a tiny, tiny little bit of dope that he rolled up for them to have a smoke of. They'd never had a smoke of it, marijuana before. And he rolled up. It was tiny. It was like a match head. There was six of them. They all took a blow and they were utterly stoned for the rest of the evening out of their heads. because this was it. They finally, and it was great to watch and great to be part of. But yeah, it was a bit like that with punk rock. The people in East Northamptonshire didn't know punk rock from a hole in the ground, but they found us and we were it, and that was it, and that was good enough for them, and so we were the punk rockers in town. Amen to that.
Absolutely. What about bands like the Desperate Bicycles and the Rivals and all this kind of other stuff that's kind of happening? Like Ace Records, I guess, would have been like what Chiswick rolled into. Was any of that stuff ever, you know, something you kind of wanted to pursue with Riff Raff, or are you guys deciding like, no, we want to do our stuff on our own?
Well, we were kind of on our own by then. You know, the momentum of punk was dying. Well, the key period while we were in East Northamptonshire in this Wobbling Heights place was 1979. And 1979 in England is the year of two-tone.
Mm-hmm.
And we were kind of out completely outside of that. We were hugely appreciative of it. We were totally into it, but we were nowhere near that. So, and by the end of the year, things had kind of, the band had started to deteriorate a bit. You know, people were drifting back to London. The gigs were turning into wine bars. And we didn't have a record deal. We didn't have an agent. So we kind of lost our grip on the momentum that we had. We lost the momentum. And we kind of had done all this great stuff, but we didn't really have much to show for it. It's not an uncommon experience for bands, I don't think.
Oh, definitely. How much touring did you guys get to do? Did you ever like tour the UK, or did you ever make it to Europe?
No. We went up and down the A1 doing places. It's all word of mouth, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we had a gig in London, we'd all jump into a friend's car and go down and do that. But they were mostly support gigs at places like the Red Cow, Hope and Anchor, the Marquee. And then, you know, various kind of like village halls and football clubs around East Northamptonshire. There was a Royal Oak pub in Peterborough we used to play regularly. But really, it was just in our little scene. You know, it never really went much further than that.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of come up on the show with people I've talked to from, you know, England around this time period, is the sort of the rise of Oi, and then ultimately sort of like the right-wing subversion of Oi. Did you have to deal with that, or was Riff Raff kind of before that really became an issue?
Yeah, we were kind of out of the way up there. There was no Oi in East Northamptonshire, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it was clearly in you know, elements of two-tone. There were certainly right-wing aspects to that. You know, the threat of the National Front was very strong in the 1970s. They were, you know, they in the mid-70s, they came third in the citywide elections after Labour and the Tories, which is pretty serious.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there always was an undercurrent. And they, you know, when we went that rehearsal studio in Raynham, I mentioned, when we were, you know, sort of early Riff Raff, which should have been sort of 75, I suppose. There are a bunch of old guys hanging around there who were trying to get some young band tooled up to play music for, you know, National Front gigs.
Wow, I remember that early they were trying to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. They were young lads and we were talking to them and they were kind of falling for it. And we were like, mate, you know, you've got to be careful what you're doing here. You're being used by these guys. But they would, you know, they weren't having it. Nothing ever came of it. But they were around all the time. So I wasn't surprised when Oi went that way.
Mm-hmm. So coming to the end of Riff Raff, what, you know, you mentioned people moving back to London. Like, what ultimately led to the demise of the band? And do you remember the last show?
The last show. Yeah, well, basically, what happened was, The guy who came around with the damned reel-to-reel tape machine ended up being the bass player. Little Kevin, his name was. And he he kind of ended up being a bass player because he was always hanging around. We had to teach him how to play the bass. Mm-hmm. But he was a really great guy. He was a lovely guy. And so there was the four of us, me and Wiggy and Robert, who'd been playing together, you know, went to school together. So we were really tight. And little Kevin, he was a lot of fun. He got ill. Robert didn't want to play anymore. He wanted to go and live in a village outside of the town. Wiggy had gone back to London. I was going to have to go back to London. You know, me and Robert were up there on our own. I was working in a restaurant, washing up in a restaurant, and he was at a job, some sort of building trade thing. So it just kind of unraveled as bands do. So I came back to London at the end of 1979, and it was really only me and Wiggy then. So we recruited a new bass player and a new drummer, but it just wasn't the same. Mm-hmm. You know, when you've been playing with people that you went to school with, and it's, you know, you've done things, and it just didn't work out, really. Didn't work out. And things had moved on. Everything was synthesizer bands. Now, it was New Romantic period. And the New Romantic, to me, was the antithesis of what punk was about, because, you know, whereas punk has said everybody's equal, you know, whether you're up on the stage or whether you're in the audience, we're all the same. The New Romantics put someone on the door to say whether or not you could come in. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That, to me, was the antithesis of punk. So I guess we didn't know what there was nowhere for us to really fit in anymore. So it kind of ended when we just ran out of gigs, and then I joined the army.
You know, it's funny you mentioned the New Romantic stuff and happening kind of, it happens at the same time as the Oi stuff happening. It's almost like punk splits and like the pretension becomes the New Romantic stuff and sort of like the working class reality becomes the Oi stuff. But it kind of becomes like, you know, they were joined at one point, it felt like.
They were. And I've had this argument with, you know, people who are involved in the New Romantics about how they were all part of punk and everything. And I'm not against it, because there were some bands that had elements of it and elements of punk that I really admire, like the Skids. They were one of my favorite bands from that period, the Skids. Mm-hmm. And when my son was 18 and went to college and came home on his first break and said to me, "Dad, how come nobody at college has ever heard of the Skids?" I knew I brought him up right.
Yeah, of course. That's awesome. I aim to do that with one of my kids at some point. If they come home, I know I've done my job.
Yeah, that's what he said. He's like, "Dad, how can they not know the Skids?" I'm like, "Son, I have to tell you something. Come sit down." Obviously, I played them a lot to him as a kid, because he's a guitar player as well, and he kind of loves their kind of like pomp and circumstance. So, you know, Rusty Egan, who was their drummer, was a big Blitz kid as well. So I love his stuff, but when I have a chance to meet him and I told him how much I loved his stuff, he was having a go at me for always, you know, banging on about Spandau Ballet, the New Romantics. And I was like, well, you know.
Well, it's like,
but, I mean, they were doing the same thing. They were self-empowering. Mm-hmm. You know, they were saying, "Okay, I'm going to go out dressed in my mum's living room curtains."
Yeah, well, like you were talking about the people early on that were painting their pants. You know, like that strand of DNA has always been in punk, and it just with New Romantic it split off again.
But there was also a kind of puritanism in punk as well. Mm-hmm. There was a puritanism in punk, and it's Sandinista, the triple album. Yeah. I was like, no way. No, I didn't sign up for my band to make triple albums. I signed up to not, you know, we're going to get rid of all this stuff. All right, London Calling is a great, great record, and I love it dearly. But, you know, they lost me, Sandinista, just out of the idea of a triple album, never mind what it sounded like. I never heard it. I know bits of it now. I do know bits of it.
Okay.
Intimately as I know the first three albums. A funny thing happened. I was doing a festival with the Levellers, and they invited me up to come and play on Police on My Back. And they threw over a bit to me to sing a verse, and I just looked at them like blank. And they, afterwards they're like, "Why don't you sing that verse?" I'm like, "Mate, I've never heard this fucking song. Never heard this. I don't know what it is." How does it go? And they were like, how can you not? But I thought you were a Clash fan. And they're a bit young. They see, they're a bit younger than me. They weren't in the Clash Wars, you know. They didn't have to go in town having cut their own hair.
Yeah, of course.
You know, like I did. Get admonished by old women and beery men.
Billy, this is one of my 300 some odd episodes that I've done, and it's got to be one of my favorite ones I've ever gotten into. This is amazing.
I'm glad. Impressions of an old punk rocker.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I just want to know, did you, before you went into the Army, of course, did you ever try doing solo stuff when you were in Riff Raff? Had you experimented with that or?
No, I'd never done that. No, I'd kind of been, the band ethic was a lot stronger then. Mm-hmm. But I'd always had the sense of the singer-songwriter, the power of the singer-songwriter alone on stage. You know, I'd been a big fan of people like Bob Dylan and the 60s singer-songwriters, and particularly the political side of it. I was very much inspired by the music of the civil rights movement, the soul side of it, but also the singer-songwriter side. So when I got into the Army, part of the reason for going in the Army was to finally rid myself of the stupid idea I was ever going to have a career in the music industry. But it didn't. It just made me want to write more. I found it really inspiring. So in the end, I kind of used it like a sabbatical. So when I came out and everything was synthesizer bands and floppy haircuts, I thought there's got to be some people who are looking for that back to basics vibe, that feel goods vibe, that rawness, that anger from punk. It can't just have disappeared. There's got to be enough people out there are still into that to find an audience for myself. How can I reach those people? And it seemed to me that the best way to do that would be to be solo, because that would give me mobility, but with an electric guitar, because that would be punk rock. Because if I had an acoustic guitar, they would make me go and play in folk clubs. They wouldn't let me play in the bars and the punk spaces, you know, the rock spaces. So the electric guitar was absolutely crucial, and weird though it is to say now, nobody had done that before. Nobody had ever seen someone go on stage and play New England like it was a Ramones song, which it kind of is. You know, it's kind of I Want to Be a Cosmonaut with a Better Chorus.
Yes.
But you know, so that kind of got people's attention. You know, it's, you know, if I knew how to be successful, I'd set up a school and teach people and search them, but I don't. But I can tell you this, there is a moment, if you want to create some cultural space for yourself, if you can work out how to do a zig when everyone else is zagging, you might just find yourself suddenly in a space on your own with an audience. That was my experience, and it was punk rock that was behind it, because I was trying to get back to that spirit. I missed that spirit in music, you know. Nobody seemed to be making the music I wanted to hear. That was the feeling I got when I saw Spandau Ballet on Top of the Pops. Mm. No one is going to be making music I want to hear. I'm going to have to do it myself. And in some ways, I was angry about that. I was like, fuck, I'm going to have to do it myself, you know? Mm-hmm. And I went upstairs at my mum's house. I picked up my guitar. And everything's been a blur since then to when we just started talking about an hour ago.
I can remember, actually, I don't think it was Top of the Pops. There used to be some British music program that they would play here on Canadian TV on Much Music. And it was like something where, you know, very much synth bands, and then you're performing. And even as like a young kid, like what you're talking about, something cutting through, like it just cut through so much.
Yeah. I remember telling the bloke from the BBC when he said, why don't you get a band and sing in tune? I said, because I'm trying to make people either turn up the radio or turn it off. Yeah. Which is not really what you wanted to hear, I don't think, but that's to me was the spirit of punk. And I've still tried to stay true to that, even though, you know, obviously I don't sound exactly like that anymore, but.
Yeah. Like, and obviously what you're doing is completely, you know, I mean, back then, like it's completely different than these artists, but there is that kind of like, you know, John Cooper Clarke, Patrick Fitzgerald, like doing different things, but like there's that continuation of sort of like this powerful solo artist voice in punk that's at the very start of it.
You know, people don't remember this now, but Patrick Fitzgerald played at the Rock Against Racism gig, the first one in Victoria Park in Hackney, you know, where the Clash played.
Yeah.
he was on the bill, and I remember seeing him, and he got bottled off.
Wow.
And I remember thinking, how stupid to come on stage solo playing a guitar at a gig like this, you idiot. Yeah. I remember thinking that. I mean, the thing was, he had an acoustic guitar, so he couldn't cut them dead. He couldn't cut through. And I think I learned a lesson there when it was my time to step up there on my own and get that adrenaline hit that I was looking for. I remembered Patrick's fate of Vicky Park and made sure that I had an electric guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically, I mean, in Riff Raff, I was the rhythm guitar player. You know, I wasn't the guitar player. I was in the rhythm section. So, you know, I was the guy, you'd only really hear what I was playing if I stopped. Then there'd be a space and you think, oh, what's that? And then, oh, it's gone now. And that's me stopping and starting, you know. Yeah. So if you listen to me, my guitar style, it's all right hand. It's not left hand fabulous guitar phrases. It's all right hand rhythm.
Which is the basis of punk anyway, right? Like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all that, you know. I think apart from Man in the Iron Mask, the whole of Life's a Riot is just right hand, right hand, right hand.
That's amazing. Yeah, no, it's like you're saying, it's just doing something completely different than everyone else is doing at that time.
Yeah, it was, and it was a simple thing as well, because other people could then think, oh, I could do this. You know, that's the other thing you want to try and do. You don't want to do something so clever that everyone thinks you're a dick. You want to do people think, yeah, I could do that.
How long was it into, you know, the solo career that you realized, like, this is something that's sustainable for the rest of my life? Like, this is, you know.
Well, I think early in 1984.
Mm-hmm.
I started playing in 1982, word of mouth. And then I recorded the
Life's a Riot.
The big riot, yeah, in the early of 1983. It got released in July 1983, and then again on Go Disc later in October, I think, 83, and that's when it really took off. But I was still the hardest working support act in showbiz in England. But what happened was, around January, February, I got on the cover of the NME, and I did a residency at the Captain's Cabin, and that, while I showed people I could top the bill and run the gig, then I started getting my own gigs and my own tours and stuff like that. So, I mean, I'm still amazed it still runs and I'm still able to do it. I feel really privileged. Obviously, at a time like this, when everything's on hold, you think to yourself, you know, is it all going to come back how it was? But even if it doesn't come back how it was, I still think I'll be able to find a space
mm-hmm.
to do what I do. And I realize I'm very privileged in that sense. You know, I've been very fortunate.
Well, it's the songs, right? The songs that were there from Riff Raff till now.
Yep.
Right.
It's the songs, it's the gigs. You know, I mean, I'm very much a performance person, and I try and connect with my audiences. These are strange times, but I do think that once they're over, people will want to get back together again in the dark and have that feeling of, sort of social solidarity that you get at a gig.
Mm-hmm.
The solidarity of song, it's not a political thing. It's just a sense that you're together. You know, over time, I've come to realize that it's not really about changing the world doing these gigs. It's about offering people a different perspective and sort of sending them home feeling as if they're not alone. Music has the opportunity to do that, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And every once in a while, you're someone's jam at the Rainbow.
Yeah, exactly. Every now and then someone connects with you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's you know, that's priceless, that when you get that feeling.
Well, Billy, I've talked to you for a long time and I could talk to you forever. Like, we barely even scratched the surface. Would you come back at some point down the line for a part two?
Sure, sure. When the Riff Raff record comes out.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. But before I let you go, I just want to talk to you once again about labels. Go Disc Records, like, you know, obviously put out your records, which are, you know, key records to music around the world. But also, like, they put out, you know, everything from Beautiful South to The Laws. Like, it's a really interesting label that once again comes out of Stiff Records.
Yeah. Weller, they put Weller out.
Yeah, Paul, absolutely. Yeah, sorry, too. Yeah, of course, not to overshadow that.
Exactly. So, yeah, it was a really good space to be, a good place to be. The people who worked there really believed in music and believed in us, you know, believed in the artists. And, you know, I remember that when the House Martins were desperately trying to get signed by Go Disc, and I was trying to do my best to help them out get there, you know, because they knew that people there were enthusiastic about music. They were very, very supportive of what we were trying to do. And they were a great little label.
It's almost like a parallel thing that's going on through Go Disc Records to what's happening in America at that time with like Homestead Records and early Sub Pop stuff, where you have kind of like the bubbling up of a new scene.
It is, yeah. And I mean, I always kind of found, you know, those places where you went, where there was a label or a scene in the city. I always found that really exciting, because that, you know, there was an aspect of that away from the center that we were doing ourselves in riffraff in the late 70s. I got a bit of a vibe from that, meeting bands out in the sticks in America and Canada.
Yeah. No, it also feels like, you know, like the stuff that was happening on Go Disc is almost like the direct precursor to the alternative Britpop, you know, whatever scene comes, you know, yeah, down the line.
I guess with the, you know, I think the House Martins had an element of Britpop in them.
Yeah,
you know, they had a bit of that sensibility there, although not so guitar driven, but they had, the way they were writing, and they were kind of regional, the House Martins, you know, they were from Hull. And that was a key part of what Britpop was about. It wasn't just about London.
Yeah, and also it just feels like even yourself, like the idea of bringing it back to roots of music and trying to be real. Like obviously Britpop becomes something else eventually too, but it just feels like the Laws is another example. Like the scene that was kind of happening was like that, you know, much in the way punk was earlier. Like that alternative scene originally was almost like a return to the roots in the same way punk was a few years later.
I have a theory, Damien, and it is that when music gets stale, the way forward can often be found at the back of the cheapo rack in your local record store. But you know what I'm saying? It's that stuff.
I know.
That stuff at the back of the rack that no one's interested in anymore. Sometimes that's the seeds of the way forward.
Absolutely. Well, anytime you want to come back here and talk about the way forward, please know the door is always open.
You're very kind, Damien. I really enjoyed talking to you, mate.
Thank you, Billy, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Billy will be back for part two. After the show, Billy's like, I really want to do that part two with you. I really enjoyed that. And that's all the praise I need. You know, I don't care that we're not one of the most popular podcasts. I don't care that we don't win those podcast awards. All I care about is that Billy Bragg wants to come back and do a part two. Woof. Woof. That'll be coming in the future. We're going to be getting more with Billy Bragg because there's a lot more to discuss. I didn't even ask him about being on CD Presents. You know, but that's for the part two. That is for that part two. Speaking of stuff that's coming up in the future, right now, as we all know, when you think of Turned Out of Punk, you think about one thing, and that is sports. We love the sports here at Turned Out of Punk. We're always talking about sports around here. And this time of year, when you love sports like we do here at Turned Out of Punk, you know it's time for one thing and one thing only. And that is the World Series of Baseball. And this year in the World Series, there are two teams. I'm pretty sure one is the LA Dodgers. Is the other one the Mets? Could it be the Mets? No, those would be both National League teams. There is another team playing in the World Series. But because of that, it is World Series week here at Turned Out of Punk. A World Series weekend, I should say, at Turned Out of Punk. Because we have, in terms of punk rock, the greatest baseball player of all time. This is someone that I've wanted to talk to way before I had this podcast. I've wanted to talk to this guy for years because, in addition to playing the baseball, he is also the lead singer or former lead singer of Scared Straight, 10-Foot Pole, and Pulley. I am talking about one Mr. Scott Radinsky. That's right. Scott Radinsky will be here because it's World Series week. He and I talk the baseball. We talk the punk rock. And you better be damn sure we talk the Nardcore. So that will be coming up for you this weekend on Turned Out a Punk. Woof. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives of Indigenous people matter. We have to protect trans kids. We have to protect trans people. go out there, get involved, read, sign petitions, show up. Now's the time, you know, like right now, look at the world around us. It sucks, but we can make it better. I know we can. We just got to say one thing first, and that's fuck fascism. And then we can move on and tackle some other problems. We got to confront fascism in all its forms and just say, yo, fuck you. We don't want you here. So please, you know, go out there and read up as much as you can. You know, that whole educate yourself thing can go awry because, you know, people put a lot of bullshit out there on the internet, but go to trusted sources, go to reliable sources and get informed, you know, read about what's happening right now. And it's not wild conspiracy theories. This is stuff that's actually happening, actually being documented right now. Abuse of people, mistreatment of people, horrible racism. And it's not just in America. I know a lot of people like picking on America, and there's certainly problems there. But right here in Canada, look what's going on in Nova Scotia right now with Indigenous people and the lobster fisheries. It is disgusting to see the treatment that's happening to Indigenous people in Canada. So please, please, please go out there and get informed. Sign petitions. Signing petitions is fucking easy. You could just sit there at your job and just click, sign petition. And if you have some money, you know, donate some money to people that are, you know, doing the activist work. And, you know, hopefully we can make a change, you know, be like a punk rock song and just, you know, like Billy Bragg, you know, just inspire change by, you know, bringing people together and kind of exposing them to different points of view. That's what Billy said. And that's all we can try and do right now. Okay. Also remember, you know, go out there and make your own culture. Put something out into the world, be it a band, a fanzine, a podcast. There's a lot of these podcasts right now, so maybe not a podcast, but do something. Go out there, get involved, sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you're not going to need them. You're going to be like, hey, you know what? I don't need this shit. Take it. Give someone else a life. There. Boom. And that's wear a mask. Wash your hands. Stay safe, everyone. Please stay safe. I love you, and I will talk to you next episode. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye. Billy Bragg, how fucking sick was that?